Donald Trump's new Commission on Religious Liberty met last week for the first time. When Trump signed the executive order in May establishing the group, he marked the occasion with these words.
They say separation between church and state, they told me. I said, all right, let's forget about that for one time. We said, really, the separation? I don't know. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure. But whether there's separation or not, you guys are in the White House where you should be, and you're representing our country, and we're bringing religion back to our country, and it's a big deal.
Now, you might ask yourself, isn't the separation of church and state guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution? Can the president just forget about it, even once? Well, the answer is a bit complicated. Today, we have another installment of our weekly series, If You Can Keep It, where we take a look at a big political story of the moment and what it means for our democracy. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. We get into Trump's administration's efforts to, quote, bring religion back right after this. Let's get right into it with our guests. Joining me in studio for the conversation is Michelle Boorstein, religion reporter at The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, Robert P. Jones. He's president and founder of the Nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute, or PRRI. He's also author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy and American Christianity. Robert, it's great to have you.
Thanks.
And joining us from his home in Virginia is Ian Millhiser. He's a senior correspondent at Vox, where he focuses on the Supreme Court and the Constitution. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Michelle, let's start with the Commission on Religious Liberty that met recently for the first time. Now, in establishing this commission, President Trump said that he was, quote, bringing religion back to the country. What does that mean?
I think the Trump administration's efforts in the second term have been more symbolic than anything else. It's basically saying we're going to kind of focus, instead of on the separation, on the rights of religion, institutional religion in particular, conservative Christians that, you know, align with the administration. So this commission, if it's similar to what happened in the first administration, will probably focus on specific things. You know, like they had a civil rights office that they created in the first Trump administration that focused on things like whether doctors, you know, were somehow pressured into that received government money were pressured into doing abortions, those kind of things. So they really had like specific, a very pretty narrow definition of what religious freedom is. We haven't seen, I mean, we've seen these big symbolic moves, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I think at this point, they're more symbolic. We'll have to see what the commissions take up, what the Justice Department takes up.
Robbie, what, if anything, is this commission actually empowered to do?
Well, I think we're going to wait and see. And what's interesting to me is that there's actually quite a bit of overlap. There was another executive order that he issued that was establishing a task force to eradicate anti-Christian bias, right? That task force actually has cabinet-level, you know, people on it. So it's everybody from Department of Defense to DOJ to all of that. And it's specifically focused on anti-Christian bias, not religious liberty writ large, but anti-Christian bias. What I noticed in this last meeting was a couple of things, is that I was expecting there to be more of a kind of Venn diagram between that anti-Christian bias thing and a religious liberty commission, which should have a much broader composition. And this one is made up of religious leaders and lay people. But if you look down the list, I mean, it is all kind of conservative, even far right folks that have been really involved in the culture war that has been kind of championed by white evangelical Protestants. And if you listen to the set of grievances that the anti-Christian task force had and the list of grievances that were aired at this meeting, there's not much of a Venn diagram. It's pretty much one circle.
And so when you're talking about the makeup of the commission, which is predominantly made up of evangelical Christians, but I believe there's a Muslim
There's some Muslim lay
scholar
leaders on the,
and, yeah,
yeah, on the commission. But if you look at the religious leaders, mm-hmm. they're all Christian and Jewish.
Let's go to this message we got from one of you.
I am very Christian. I go to church pretty much every week, and I read the Bible every day. And I think the separation of church and state is so fundamental to both an American lifestyle and a Christian lifestyle. Everybody always talks about what the founding fathers wanted, and that's pretty much what they wanted.
We also got this email from Paul, who says it's worth remembering that the Founding Fathers specifically rejected England's monarchy that historically intermingled church and state. Separation of church and state is the very first line item of the Constitution's Bill of Rights. This suggests that it was very important to the Founding Fathers. Ian, first, briefly, what does the Constitution say about the relationship between religion and government? Just remind us.
So the Constitution says two things about the relation between religion and government. There's a provision called the Free Exercise Clause, and that essentially says that to a certain extent, the government has to stay out of your faith. You are allowed to practice your faith. The government can't stop it. And there's some questions about where to draw the line there, but that's the general principle. And then there's this thing called the Establishment Clause. And this Establishment Clause is where historically the idea of church-state separation has come from. The idea is that there can't be an established church. The government should not determine what our religion is or declare that there's an official state religion. And again, there's a lot of line-drawing questions there about what that means. But you have these two somewhat contradictory principles. Everyone's allowed to practice their own faith, but the government isn't allowed to advance religion or promote a particular religious belief.
So, Robbie, give us a brief history lesson on why these provisions were included in our founding documents. We had one listener already weigh in.
Well, you know, I'll give you a personal one. So I grew up Southern Baptist in the South, and historically, Southern Baptists were strict separationists. Now, you say, so why is that, right? They were Christian, Protestant, and the reason is because in the early days of the country and in the colonial period, for example, in Virginia, if you were Baptist, you couldn't organize in a church because it was an official Anglican colony. And so Baptists grew up thinking, we are a religious minority. We want free exercise. We want the ability to marry people, to organize churches, all of that. And that really lasted up until the middle of the 20th century. And what we've seen, I think what we're seeing is an unraveling of a very old set of commitments among white evangelical Christians that have really moved since the civil rights movement up to the forward. And it really does stem from that. And it stems from this sense that the federal government was intervening in white Christians' ability, frankly, to hold segregationist schools and policies in the South. And that idea that the government is interfering with our free exercise of religion has real roots in the kind of trying to hold on to white supremacy in the South among white Christians.
And so what I hear you saying here is that the evolution we've seen is less about, in your assessment, less about an exercise of a religion and more about an exercise of segregation practices?
Well, it's two things. I mean, I think what's interesting here is that when groups find themselves in the minority, they're very easily saying, oh, let's have free exercise for everyone, right? Let's have non-establishment because we want the same rights as everyone else. I think the tragic story of Southern Baptists, and these again are kind of my people, is that they became the largest expression of Protestant Christianity in the country by the 1950s. And once they reached that kind of majority status, their commitments to church-state separation and the same rights they had all along insisted for themselves begin to kind of fall away.
Now, Ian, you've written, quote, the amount of church and state separation in the U.S. tends to ebb and flow depending on who sits on the Supreme Court. Now, we currently have a court with a conservative majority, a majority that Trump wanted, and that religious conservatives wanted. So how much has this court impacted the ebb and flow so far?
Tremendously. So, you know, for most of the 20th century, the Supreme Court believed very firmly in a firm separation of separation of church and state. No tax in any amount, large and small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions. That's a line from a 1947 Supreme Court decision. Now, if anything, the court has declared separation of church and state unconstitutional in many cases. So 3 years ago, there was a case called Carson, where they said that in states that have school voucher programs, those vouchers must be used to fund religious education. So not just they may be used, states have the option to have some entanglement of government and faith, but it is required now that they must do it. I don't think you can explain why this happens without referring to partisan politics. The Supreme Court has become much more partisan than it has ever been. I mean, as recently as 2010, we had Justice John Paul Stevens, who was a liberal Republican. Those don't exist anymore on the Supreme Court. And the two parties have, I think, developed you know, very sophisticated standing of their belief of religion. The Republican Party wants, as we heard from that Trump quote at the beginning of the segment, you know, wants no separation between church and state. So you have a court that's become very partisan. You have a Republican Party that wants to eliminate the separation of church and state. And you have a 6 Republican justice majority on the Supreme Court. It's not hard to guess what happens when you have those conditions.
Well, we got this email from Amy who says, I'm a nurse in Southern Oregon and a worship leader at my Presbyterian church. I believe with all my heart that our country was founded on the principles of having the freedom to choose your religion, and that is being destroyed by the current administration. We are not a theocracy, and we were never meant to be. Michelle, we heard mention of the Department of Justice's new office, this executive order signed by President Trump to eradicate anti-Christian bias. Give us a little more detail on what that office is doing right now, or at least what they're tasked with doing.
Yeah, there's a little bit more information about that task force compared to the religious freedom one. Basically, the administration put out when they had a formal announcement of the anti-Christian bias task force, what they considered to be examples. And the examples were things like churches that didn't want to have to wear masks or stay open, or a church in Virginia whose pastor wanted to explicitly endorse Trump. So they really weren't about religion so much as they were sort of about partisan politics, mm-hmm. or that kind of thing, which obviously have merged in our society in a lot of ways. So, I think you have different party. There's different groups who have different interests right now. I mean, you certainly have Christian nationalists, people who are, you know, sort of that school, motivated by, you know, this is our country and we're under God and, you know, we all believe sort of the same thing. That's our culture. And then you've had in recent decades, for example, schools that Jewish schools, Muslim schools that have sort of come up in the era of like, well, we should be able to get funding too. That's discrimination against us. So they may not be motivated by exactly the same things. You know, Catholic schools, for example, the schools were such a fundamental part of the Catholic Church. And I think for them, getting funding was more about their schools than it was about Christian nationalism. I mean, there's you know, different versions, but I just mean there's different groups with different interests kind of coming together.
Yeah, and Robbie, where do you fall on this idea of anti-Christian bias, that it is a real thing? Because, and to be clear, we're not talking about an interpersonal exchange where someone may not be a fan of Christianity, but I'm talking about at a policy level.
Yeah.
Is that a real thing?
Well, you know, luckily we have some facts that we can look to on this question. It's an empirical question about how real, you know, is this? So, you know, one way to look at this is, you know, the government actually compiles records of hate crimes that are religiously motivated. And so if we look at that, the last report we have from the FBI is that there were 2,833 hate crimes that were motivated by religious bias in 2023, which is the most recent data we have available. Only 10% of those were motivated by anti-Christian bias. The vast majority of them were motivated by anti-Jewish bias or anti-Semitism, and another kind of 1 in 10 were kind of motivated by other non-Christian groups. So you've got to look at this. It's really only like 1 in 10, hate crimes, like the real serious kinds of threats, right? That's about as serious as it gets. The interesting thing is that when you also ask about perception, so that's the facts on the ground. When you ask about perception, we polled on this at PRRI. When you ask about a question, something like, you know, today discrimination against Christians has become as serious as a problem as discrimination against other groups, it's only about 1 in 3 Americans who believe that, right? So by a margin of 2 to 1, Americans reject that premise. But notably, to the point that this is all being seen through partisan lens, who believes that? Well, there's 2 groups that believe that. It are people who self-identify as Republican and 2/3 of white evangelical Protestants. But I should note, that's the only Christian group, right, that believes that strongly. Most other Christian, even Christian groups, they don't feel that way.
So, Michelle, if the data doesn't support this idea that there is anti-Christian bias, how would you characterize the way the Trump administration is using anti-discrimination laws compared to how they were designed to be used?
Well, I think I mean, they have successfully, you know, including in the previous Trump administration, kind of tapped into this idea of grievance among, you know, majority groups, right? Whites, Christians. So I think the question for them is, like, going forward, are they primarily going to kind of stick to this more like symbolic rhetoric, or are they going to really pursue cases, you know, that they, and how will the American public respond? Like, when people really look at, is this an example of anti-Christian bias, this pastor who wasn't allowed to endorse from the pulpit, when that's the same rule for any nonprofit, how will Americans, if they start hopefully paying attention, will see this? And one of the things I've wondered is if it, you know, looking, and Ian can talk about this maybe, but the Supreme Court cases that are underway that remind about religion remind me of the ones around abortion, where you kind of have different states basically doing different things, including funding religious schools, for example.
Right. And Ian, speaking of the Supreme Court, there is a case under consideration now called Mahmoud v. Taylor. Outline that case for us quickly.
This is potentially a huge case. So the issue here is you have a school district in Maryland that has approved the use of some books that have some queer characters in them. It's not entirely clear what the books are being used for. The factual record hasn't been fully developed in the case, but these books will be used for some purposes in these public school classrooms. And then you have a group of parents, some of them Muslim, some of them Christian, who object to these books being taught to their children. The thing that they are demanding from the Supreme Court, and I think the court is likely to give it to them, is a right to be warned in advance if the school is going to teach anything that offends their faith, and then be given the opportunity to opt out. And I've got to tell you, I'm worried for public schools because of this case. Because, I mean, it's pretty predictable that if you're going to teach a book with gay characters in it, we know that people with religious objections to homosexuality are fairly common in the United States. But the one thing that the court has been absolutely clear about throughout its development of its religion cases is that you can't discriminate against faiths. So if you give people with a common religious belief a certain benefit, you have to give it to people with idiosyncratic religious beliefs. There have been cases involving people who didn't want their children to be taught books with magic in them. So no Harry Potter, no Narnia. There was a case involving a family that didn't want their child to learn about women having accomplishments outside of the home. There was a case involving someone who didn't want their child to be taught false beliefs about death, whatever that means. And so what I worry about is that if the court does what I think it's likely to do, which is give these parents the right to be warned in advance, they're going to have to give it to every parent. And how is the school district going to know what idiosyncratic religious beliefs every single parent in that school has so that they can know to warn them in order to comply with the Supreme Court ruling?
Robert, in our final moments here, I want to get your response to this email we received from Stuart, who says, I think many forget that historically merging church and state has gone poorly for the church. Doesn't the government usually win in a dispute? Separation of religion and government protects the church.
Well, that has always, you know, that's really been the orthodox, even Southern Baptist position on this, is that, you know, the argument I remember hearing growing up was, oh, you look at Europe, all their churches are dying, right? There are all these official state churches that are being funded by the state, and there's one preferred church, and everyone else has a kind of secondary status. Here in the U.S., we've had this kind of vibrant free market of religion, and I think, you know, we have a good sense that this is actually good for government. It is also good for religion in the country.
Well, lots more to discuss. We will return to this conversation, so keep sending your comments and your questions our way. Email us at 1a@wamu.org. We've been speaking with Robert P. Jones. He's the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, Michelle Borstein, religion reporter at The Washington Post, and Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox. Thanks to you all. Today's show was produced by Alexandra Botti and edited by Matthew Simonson. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.